Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. President Obama became the first sitting American president to visit the Japanese city of Hiroshima today. On August 6, 1945, the first atomic bomb dropped by a United States aircraft devastated an area of 5 square miles. Hiroshima's population at the time was 350,000. 140,000 people were killed. And then 3 days later, the U.S. launched an even bigger atomic bomb on Nagasaki, which killed nearly 74,000 people. A similar number were injured, and that bomb weighed nearly 9,000 pounds. Today, President Obama said there is a shared responsibility to look into the eye of history and ask what must be done to prevent another nuclear weapon being used. So how are reporters covering this history? A lot of media outlets are talking to survivors. On All Things Considered yesterday, Hiroshima survivor Setsuko Thurlow pointed out that President Obama has committed $1 trillion to modernize the nuclear weapons system. So why isn't this plan getting more attention in the media? When the president visited Vietnam, he pushed for human rights and the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal, which Public Citizen has called NAFTA on steroids. His potential successor opposed the TPP, so why is he pushing for it? Well, joining me to talk about media coverage of President Obama's visit to Vietnam and Japan are two guests. Mary Kay Magstad spent more than 2 decades in East Asia from the late 80s to 2013 as Southeast Asia and then China correspondent for NPR and then also for PRI's The World. Mary Kay is creator and host of the podcast Whose Century Is It?, a co-production with PRI's The World. And Mary Kay joins me in studio. Hi, Mary Kay. Thanks for coming in.
Hi. Great to be here.
Great to have you. We're also joined by Tim Shorrock, a journalist who grew up in Japan and South Korea in the 1950s and 60s. Tim has been writing about the region and U.S. policy in East Asia for many years for The Nation and other publications. And Tim is author of the book Spies for Hire, The Secret World of Intelligence Outsourcing. Hi, Tim. Welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much.
Great to have both of you. And I should mention that Mary Kay has a piece out called Bridging Divided Wartime Memories. President Obama's visit to Hiroshima strikes a powerful chord. She wrote that for PRI. And Tim wrote a piece for The Nation called Here's What Obama Should Do When He Visits Hiroshima. An apology for unleashing the first nuclear holocaust in human history is in order and long overdue. And you can find their pieces at yourcallradio.org. So as we always do on our media roundtable, we start off on a positive note and point to really good reporting this week. So, Mary Kay, let's start off with you. What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
So I saw a long essay by Howard French, who's an accomplished and gifted writer, journalist, photographer, and now professor at Columbia University. This was in The Guardian on May 24th. And he was talking about two things. First of all, what it was like for him to be an African-American journalist coming up through the ranks at the New York Times and the sort of bias that he saw in terms of what it was considered appropriate for him to cover. You know, if he was going to be a foreign correspondent, he was going to go to the Caribbean or Africa. Hmm. When he wanted to go to Japan, it was like, well, do you really think you can do that? Other African-American journalists at the New York Times, he said, when they wanted to cover tech, it was like, well, that's not really, I mean, you don't know enough about tech, whereas, you know, white journalists who didn't know a lot about tech were channeled into that area without much pushback. But he also said, in general, in the United States, there are so few African Americans in positions of decision-making authority in journalism that it skews the kind of journalism we have, that only somewhere between 4 and 5% of journalists in newspapers in the United States are African American, and the number's actually going down. So he said, you know, just be aware of, you know, that the kind of issues that are put in front of us, that the kinds of things we're thinking about are not the only issues out there, and the way that they're presented are also presented in a particular way. And we'd all do well to have a more multicultural approach to how we think about the ideas that shape our lives.
When was he at the New York Times?
Until a few years back, and then he shifted over to the Columbia University's Journalism School. He's written a really interesting book in the interim called China's Second Continent. So after Japan, he went to China. Hmm. He was a New York Times correspondent in Shanghai. And then he combined his experience from Africa and China and looked at China's influence now in Africa.
Wow, that would be a really good show, actually, because we often talk about media consolidation and so many media outlets that are either shutting down bureaus or firing so many reporters. And statistics show that people of color tend to be the first journalists to be let go.
Mm. Well, yeah. In fact, one of the statistics he gave in his essay was that 15 years ago, something like 5.4% or 5.6% of journalists working for American newspapers were African American. Now it's 4.8%.
Wow. All right. So kudos to Howard French.
Howard French.
French. Thank you. That we have to do a show on this. It would be really interesting to get him on the show. That is Mary Kay Magstad. She is a longtime reporter who spent more than two decades in East Asia. And what about you, Tim? What did you see this week that you thought was done well?
Well, I've been in South Korea for the last 2 weeks, so I've been haven't kept up that much with the U.S. media, but I would say that the one story I saw that was really, really good, and again, this is another Guardian story, Mark Hertzgaard, this was actually last Sunday, May 22, has an excellent investigation of called How the Pentagon Punished NSA Whistleblowers. And, you know, I've written about these NSA whistleblowers a few years ago in The Nation. He really advances the story because he found a top Pentagon official whose job was supposed to be protecting whistleblowers. And in this article, this person, John Crane, describes in detail how officials at the top ranks of the Pentagon, who are, you know, like I said, supposed to be protecting whistleblowers, were actually undermining them by reporting, you know, passing their names on to investigators who later, you know, use the information to arrest some of these NSA whistleblowers. And it's quite an amazing story about the depths to which the Pentagon and the Obama administration itself have stifled whistleblowers and gone after whistleblowers. And I thought that was a really excellent story.
All right. So kudos to Mark Hertzgaard, who's a reporter for The Nation. He also fills in on the Friday Media Roundtable from time to time. He has a new book out about this issue, right, Tim?
I think so, yeah. I heard a bit on the radio yesterday about it.
All right. So, yeah, we're going to invite Mark to come on the show in the near future to talk about that. That is Tim Shorrock. He is a longtime journalist who, as he says, just got back from South Korea. And you can find Mark's piece at yourcallradio.org. So let's dive in and talk about this historic trip to Hiroshima. Both of you have covered this region for decades, and there's so many layers to this. Mary Kay, you wrote a piece for PRI called Bridging Divided Wartime Memories: President Obama's Visit to Hiroshima Strikes a Powerful Chord. As someone who spent more than two decades in East Asia, how do you decide what angle to take for such an historic visit like this?
Well, I should add that I actually did a 45-minute podcast on this subject, on history, memory, and Hiroshima. And basically, the question of how history shapes a society's present and future has always been of great interest to me. I've covered societies that have been through civil upheaval, incredibly traumatic chapters in their history, you know, Cambodia, Rwanda, China, post-Cultural Revolution. And I've seen how the way that history is faced or not faced has ripple effects, for better and for worse, throughout society. And I've certainly felt this in China related to Japan, and in Japan when I visited Japan, and in fact throughout the region, throughout Southeast Asia and East Asia. So I thought this was a really important angle to take. And I have the luxury as a podcaster and as someone who's not hitting the news, you know, square on the nose, but who's thinking about, well, what's not being said? What's beneath the surface that really matters? That this deserves some time and thought and meditation. So that's what I did.
And we have our own narrative, or I should say the U.S. government has its own narrative of what happened. There are many narratives out there. How do you tackle that as a reporter?
Sure. Well, and so I think one of the appropriate starting points is to recognize that we have one narrative of what happened in the Pacific War. And that, in fact, as my main interviewee in my podcast, Dan Snyder, who's a former Christian Science Monitor journalist in Japan, who is now at Stanford's Shorenstein Center. He's doing a project called Divided Memory and Reconciliation, looking at some of these issues post-war in East Asia. And, you know, he says that it's really important to recognize that each society has sort of shaped its understanding of what happened, and that for the U.S., this was a messy, brutal war that didn't have a black hats, white hats kind of narrative the way that fighting the Nazis did. There was a racist element to how both sides, the Japanese and the United States, viewed each other during the war. You know, the propaganda was very racist. And from the Japanese side, you know, as they were coming up in the 20s and the 30s, and they saw themselves as a rising power in the same sort of way that European powers had been in the 18th and 19th century, that the United States had been in the 19th and early 20th century. What did those powers do? They went out and they got themselves some colonies, and they were more muscular in the world, and they, you know, just sort of stretched out and found new room for themselves. And so when I've interviewed Japanese about how the war is portrayed elsewhere, they're saying, well, look, you know, we were liberating Asia from the European colonialists. Now, a lot of East Asians, and certainly Southeast Asians where I live, are like, well, we didn't want to be liberated by the Japanese. We didn't really enjoy that experience at all. That's their narrative. You know, so you have all these competing narratives. Everyone's got their own way of looking at it. And, you know, I think any effort to try to bring them together and to say, okay, we recognize, at least we recognize in Hiroshima, standing here on this day, that pain was caused, that you endured this experience. We recognize this happened to you. I think there is power in just doing that.
Tim, what would you add to that? What strikes you about how reporters are covering this history and the different narratives?
Well, it really is difficult because the overriding narrative is, you know, the U.S. did this great thing by ending the war quickly by dropping the atomic bombs. But, you know, talking about the role of Japan, when I grew up in Japan in the 50s and 60s, the overall narrative was, you know, Japanese were victims because of this atomic bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And I think it covered, and there was the real story of how Japan started this war. Many Japanese rightists defend their imperial advances and what they did in Asia, but this was a military invasion of Asia. The colonization of Korea was terrible. In China there was terrible atrocities committed against Chinese. The Japanese did things that were in the way they treated, you know, Allied prisoners of war. It was a cruel, cruel regime, cruel, cruel imperial regime. And the atomic bombing somehow allowed Japan to kind of view itself as victim. And that's what I wrote in The Nation was that, you know, I believe that Obama should have apologized for that atomic bombing and also, you know, focusing on, you know, killing so many civilians because they knew they were going to be killing hundreds of thousands of people that had nothing to do with the war, who were just, you know, people living in these cities as they did in Tokyo and many other cities in Japan. And I think that was a terrible thing, and you can look at the history of you know, people have studied closely the decision making that led up to it, and, you know, I believe that the atomic bombings were unnecessary, that Japan was ready to surrender and would have surrendered without them. But, you know, this counter-narrative the Japanese offer, I think, you know, really does cover up their war crimes. And it's allowed, you know, Japan to kind of view itself, you know, many Japanese to view themselves as victims. And I think that's a very, you know, incorrect narrative because of what they did. And so I think that's part of what's missing. But what I also found was most missing, I mean, there's a shadow behind both of these visits, which I believe is the shadow of American militarism since World War II. I mean, his biggest accomplishment in Vietnam was, you know, selling advanced U.S. weapons. And, you know, in Japan, there's this whole backdrop to this, which is what's going on in Okinawa when the U.S. is insisting on expanding its marine presence, when the entire island wants U.S. bases out, if, you know, if not reduced, dramatically. They want U.S. Marine presence there lowered, and because almost all the U.S. bases in Japan are in Okinawa, and this has been a major issue in Okinawa, and also in, you know, there was just a couple of weeks ago, another Okinawan woman was raped and murdered by a U.S. worker at a U.S. military base there. And, you know, these are the repercussions of militarism. And I think that our alliance with Japan, well, the United States, the New York Times called it extraordinary, you know, people kind of forget that, you know, in the U.S. occupation, the first couple of years of the occupation, we're good. We tried to restore democracy in Japan. And, in fact, we did help restore democracy in Japan. But there was something called the reverse occupation when Japan became they became a junior partner to the U.S. in the Cold War, and Japan profited greatly from the U.S. war in Korea. Japan profited greatly from the U.S. war in Vietnam. And, you know, we allied ourselves with a very right-wing party in Japan, the Liberal Democratic Party, which still holds power. And Abe, the prime minister, you know, he comes from this party, and comes from a whole generation of line of politicians who emerged out of this extreme right-wing regime in Japan starting from the early 50s. So I think that's part of the history that's missing here.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with everything you just said. Just a couple of extra thoughts. You know, certainly the Japanese in China over the course of 14 years of occupying parts of China were responsible for about 20 million deaths. I mean, it was horrific. In Southeast Asia, there are still traumatic memories about what the Japanese did. The Abe government, at least officials within the Abe government, were not entirely enthusiastic about Obama's visit because there was some pushback saying, well, if he goes to Hiroshima, then do we need to go to Pearl Harbor? And then do we need to go to Nanjing, where the Nanjing massacre killed about 200,000 people? But then if you follow that line of thinking, it actually leads to other interesting questions. I lived in China for 15 years and covered China, where there is a very strong narrative that, you know, the Japanese were and to some extent still are monsters, and they'd never apologized enough. But the Chinese Communist Party, which is now in power and which kind of controls the historical narrative very aggressively by censoring whatever it doesn't want people to know, was responsible for twice as many deaths over the course of its time in power. The Great Famine in the late 50s and early 60s killed about 30 million people. More were killed in anti-rightist purges in the 50s and then again during the Cultural Revolution. So there is this question of, you know, if anyone starts facing history more honestly, is it contagious? Or do people just try to shut it down as quickly as possible and move on?
Mary Kay Magstad spent more than two decades in East Asia from the late 80s to 2013. She is creator and host of the podcast Whose Century Is It?, which gives her the luxury of spending 40 minutes. Is that right?
That's how long the last one was, yeah, 40,
so,
45.
What I find so interesting about that is if you were a reporter for NPR there today, you'd have maybe 8 minutes.
Oh, if I were lucky, yeah.
Right.
I mean, 8 minutes is a long radio piece for NPR or PRI. For a news piece, it would probably be more like 3 to 5.
To five nowadays. Yeah. And also the other thing is sometimes with these kinds of stories, you get reporters flying with the president, so they don't have that historical context.
Exactly. I mean, I think NPR and the New York Times would also have their reporters based in Japan or based in the region reporting on an issue like this. But quite often, like in a press conference where President Obama is answering questions or the Secretary of State is answering questions or whomever, it's the traveling press who get called on, which is quite frustrating to those of us when, you know, we're based in the region and actually have a lot of background knowledge to draw on to ask questions.
Right, and to bring all of the information you and Tim are bringing to the table.
Yeah.
Tim, what would you add to that?
Pardon me?
What would you add to that?
I think... You know, I just was in Korea, and I think what a lot of Americans don't realize about, you know, World War II and the post-war period, you know, the shadow of what happened of, you know, Japanese colonialism and throughout this whole period, you know, is still there. I mean, you know, South Korea is a very complex society. Americans tend to view, you know, look at Korea and only see North Korea and not even try to understand what's going on in South Korea and the dynamics of its, you know, political situation, economic situation. And, you know, there are many issues in South Korea now about, you know, South Korean politicians whose fathers or they themselves were collaborators with the Japanese colonial regime there that was, you know, lasted from, you know, 1910 to 1945. You know, the whole division of Korea was, you know, came out of, you know, the Japanese colonial period and the political divisions that itself created. And, you know, when the United States occupied the southern part of Korea after World War II, they basically treated Korea like an enemy nation, and they kept some of the Japanese collaborators in power in South Korea. And that whole, none of that, it's never really been quite worked out, and there's still repercussions of all that. So, you know, what Japan did, what the U.S. did in World War II, and what they've done since then, you know, still very much with Asian peoples, and I think the history is so much more complicated than this sort of simple narrative that we often see in the press.
And Tim, in your piece in The Nation, you wrote that an apology for unleashing the first nuclear holocaust in human history is in order and long overdue. You briefly touched on this earlier, and I'm wondering what your thoughts are on the reporting about that, because this morning on NPR, in passing, a reporter said that the survivors who were there today to listen to President Obama did not ask for an apology. The survivors who want an apology were not there, and I'd love to know the backstory behind that. But the New York Times' Chosung Hung has a piece, and it says, as many as 220,000 people were killed by the atomic bombs that the U.S. dropped on Japan, most Japanese civilians. 40,000 to 50,000 of the dead were Koreans who had been taken to Hiroshima or Nagasaki against their will as forced laborers or had settled in the cities after fleeing deprivation in their occupied homeland. Lee Soo-young, 88, whose parents took her to Hiroshima in search for food when she was just 7, was quoted in this New York Times piece saying, if there's anyone he must apologize to, isn't it the innocent non-Japanese victims like the Koreans? We Koreans didn't start the war. Most of us were there because the Japanese forced us to be there.
Yeah, that's a very important point, and I'm glad that people have brought that out. And I think, you know, I did see the reports of, you know, Japanese, you know, survivors saying they didn't want an apology. And I think, you know, that's fine. I think for them the significance was, you know, American president coming there and, you know, acknowledging, you know, the awful nature of that bombing and the awful repercussions of that bombing, you know, which lasted for decades. You know, people dying from the, you know, atomic disease with the, you know, the radiation sickness and all that. And so, you know, that's very important that Obama would acknowledge that and say, you know, this was a terrible thing. But the problem is, you know, the role of Koreans there, the fact that there were so many Koreans there, forced laborers, many of them, you know, were brought forcibly to Japan by the Japanese authorities who employed them in coal mines and, you know, industries when Japanese soldiers went to war. A lot of that's forgotten. I think that's, you know, that's part of the sort of heritage and the history of Japanese, you know, colonial actions that took place, you know, prior to World War II and during World War II that is not really covered very much. And I think the fact that, you know, that this has been brought out in the press is very important, because yeah, there was a lot of Korean victims, and you know, they felt, you know, completely marginalized for years and years and years, and it took them you know, years, decades to get any kind of compensation, which they've gotten very little of from their governments.
This piece, Mary Kay, is called Korean Survivors of Atomic Bombs Renew Fight for Recognition and Apology. And there's a photo of Kim Il-jo, an 88-year-old woman who survived. And she said she returned to South Korea and was shunned and denied care, partly to preserve the official view that the nuclear attacks were necessary to liberate Korea.
Yeah, there's a lot of injustice around, you know, the decisions that were made in World War II, you know, injustice, atrocities, even for, you know, Americans who say, you know, the dropping the bombs was justified, it was necessary, it saved lots of lives. it destroyed and damaged lots of lives, too. And it's important to recognize all of that when remembering history.
And it's also, people might remember the film about Robert McNamara, where Robert McNamara was one of the former Secretary of Defense, best known for, deepening her involvement in Vietnam during the Kennedy administration. But, he helped plan the bombing of Japan under General Curtis LeMay. And then this film about him, he said, we probably should have been called a war criminal for what we did in Japan, but we didn't because we were the victor. But this mass killing of civilians, I think, was so horrific. And, I know many Japanese, who survived. My own stepmother, lived in Tokyo during that time, and, people by the end of the war were starving. But, the whole city, the cities were just, burnt. They were just incinerated with tons and tons of napalm and, firebombs. And, it was a horror. And the horror of that war is it's always remained in my memory.
Tim Shorrock is a journalist who grew up in Japan and South Korea in the 50s and 60s. Mary Kay Magstad spent more than two decades in East Asia from the late 80s to 2013. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
This is Your Call on Local Public Radio, KALW. If you have a perspective you haven't heard in today's discussion or a question that you feel needs to be answered, please join the conversation by calling 866-798-8255. That's 866-798-TALK, toll free. You can also send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org or post a comment or question at the show's website, yourcallradio.org.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, it is our media roundtable. We are talking about President Obama's historic visit to Hiroshima. He spoke this morning. He gave a 20-minute talk saying there is a shared responsibility to look into the eye of history and ask what must be done to prevent another nuclear weapon from being used. So what are your thoughts about the coverage? Are you seeing coverage of President Obama's plan to upgrade nuclear weapons? It's a 30-year, $1 trillion nuclear plan. He also visited Vietnam, where he talked about human rights and pushed for the Trans-Pacific Partnership trade deal, which Public Citizen calls NAFTA on steroids. His potential successors oppose the TPP. So why is he pushing this so hard? What are your thoughts on the reporting on that angle? And if you have any thoughts on the reporting that you've seen on Hiroshima, we'd also love to hear from you. It's getting a lot of coverage, and we're hearing from a lot of survivors. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we're joined by Mary Kay Magstad. She spent more than two decades in East Asia from the 80s to 2013 as Southeast Asia and then China correspondent for NPR, and also PRI's The World. She is the creator and host of the podcast Whose Century Is It?, a co-production with PRI's The World. And if you have some time over the weekend, she did a 45-minute podcast on the significance of the visit to Hiroshima. Tim Shorrock is a journalist who grew up in Japan and South Korea in the 50s and 60s. He's been writing about the region and U.S. policy in East Asia for The Nation and other publications. And Tim is author of the book Spies for Hire, The Secret World of Intelligence Outsourcing. And let's hear from Mark in Berkeley. Hi, Mark. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for the show. I just wanted to say that this $1 trillion nuclear bill that Obama signed is largely an abandonment of the treaty concept, which, like it or not, we did successfully do with the Soviets, now Russians, and The Obama bill is in much of it is like a make work program. Like this interoperability concept. It's sort of a fantasy in the last like 30 minutes of human existence. You know, the Navy will have used all their nuclear weapons so they can call up the Marines, and the nuclear bombs they have, they can give them to the Navy, and they'll go into their missiles. So they're taking a lot of the nuclear bombs in the stockpile now and changing them, the casing, so that they can fit into the different missiles. But like I say, a lot of it seems like make work and fantasy, and it's disappointing step away from world, you know, process of treaties and all that. So I just wanted to say that. I'll take comments on the air. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. Tim Shorrock, what are your thoughts on coverage of this? Dr. Lawrence Wintner, a professor of history at SUNY, wrote a piece in the History News Network that was also picked up by the Bill Moyers website. And his piece, isn't it rather odd that America's largest single public expenditure scheduled for the coming decades has received no attention in the presidential debates? And he's referring to this 30-year, $1 trillion program to modernize the U.S. nuclear arsenal. This hasn't really gotten much attention with all this coverage on the presidential election.
It sure has not. And I think that's really too bad, because I think it's a little bit, you know, hypocritical for Obama to come there to Hiroshima and say, you know, we need a moral revolution, and to sort of, you know, in the long range of time, eventually eradicate these kind of weapons while we're doing this massive buildup. But I also want to say that in regards to Japan, you know, for decades the U.S. has, have brought ships to Japan, Navy ships, that were nuclear armed. And, you know, I remember being there in 1981, I think it was, when the former U.S. ambassador to Tokyo, Edwin Reischauer, gave an interview to a Japanese newspaper, and he said, you know, during his time and previous to his time, the U.S. had violated, you know, the agreements with Japan not to bring in nuclear weapons by bringing them in, and often did not even inform the Japanese. And this was, you know, a huge issue back in the 80s. But they've been sort of, you know, bringing in nuclear, Japan has been under the so-called nuclear umbrella, for decades as part of the U.S. military alliance. But they have been, you know, bringing in nuclear weapons there, and many Japanese were so shocked when they heard that. And I think, you know, that created a lot of tension. So I think there is this kind of contradiction in American policy. And, you know, certainly this huge program to build nuclear weapons is certainly not, you know, getting the kind of coverage it deserves at this time, when we go there and say, you know, what a terrible thing nuclear weapons were in World War II.
Mary Kay, this is not the focus of your piece, but what do you think about the coverage of the contradictions that Tim is talking about?
Well, I think one thing that's going on behind all of this is that China is rising as a military power in the region and in the world. And both Japan and the United States are joined in their concern about the muscularity with which China has asserted its sovereignty over the South China Sea and the East China Sea, what the Japanese call the Senkaku Islands and the Chinese call the Diaoyu Islands. And I think the entire military alliance is being made more robust as a way of pushing back against China. And speaking of narratives, I mean, the Chinese narrative is, hey, you had your chance to rise in the world. Now it's our turn. You have your backyard. Then, you know, it goes all the way back to the Monroe Doctrine. Why are you acting like this to us? And by the way, you're a Western power. You don't even belong here. This belongs to, you know, we Asians. And, you know, we are the rightful Middle Kingdom that should be controlling this region. There's, you know, the whole set of ethical and moral issues around the nuclear program, but that is, in real politique, the other thing that's going on.
How does the arms race get covered in China?
It doesn't. Not really. The Chinese newspapers don't really talk about how much China's military program is spending, or, you know, there will be coverage of Japanese military aggression or perceived aggression. And when there are anti-Japanese protests, as there were in 2005, 2007, 2012, they've been increasingly orchestrated. In the 2012 demonstrations, there was, you know, basically coordinated coverage in the state-run media about how the Japanese were basically playing chicken in the East China Sea and claiming territory that wasn't theirs. And, you know, in fact, there had been a status quo, and the Chinese military started to go in and started to, in fact, buzz Japanese planes and ships. And they have a technique of going very, very close to other planes that are in the air, like within 50 feet. In fact, you might recall that back in 2000, a Chinese plane went down near Hainan Island in southern China, which became a big incident between China and the United States. They're still doing that. The Chinese say, and we have the right to do that. This is our territory. The Japanese say, well, no, you don't, and no, it isn't. But, you know,
I wonder what our response would be if the Chinese had a massive military presence in Puerto Rico and were, you know, sending, you know, surveillance planes up and down the East Coast and all this kind of
thing. No, totally.
I think there's a couple factors here that aren't often covered, you know, which is, you know, this government in Japan is the most right-wing government probably in its history. It's backed by what they call, you know, revisionists who sort of want to revise, you know, what the Japan's role and revise the historical interpretation of Japan's role in World War II, backed by, you know, military contractors who really want to sell weapons overseas. And, you know, Abe has been pushing the limits of Japan's peace constitution, you know, just lifted some restraints on allowing Japanese soldiers to, you know, fight abroad, fight overseas. And they've lifted the ban on, you know, exporting Japanese weapons. Japanese weapons makers are being very aggressive and trying to sell to Australia and other countries in the region. You know, I think the U.S. military presence there has been historically very heavy. They always have a major enemy they want to name, North Korea, China, whatever. But I'm not sure if it is a massive presence. You know, we have 7th Fleet in Japan. We have Marines in Okinawa. A huge presence in South Korea. You know, this is not, you know, it's just a small military footprint. This is huge. And, you know, I just think that there's a lot of what's missing is the size of the U.S. military presence and the moves by the Japanese to support that.
Yeah, and then on top of that, there's also, you know, how are different people in the region perceiving the U.S. military presence. And that's changed over time. I mean, I remember doing a series back in 2005 about how traditional U.S. allies were perceiving China's rise. And at the time, you know, China was talking about, you know, peaceful rise, you know, everyone becomes more prosperous, everyone benefits. And at the time, the U.S. was very focused on the war on terror. And so I went to, you know, South Korea, Japan, Thailand, the Philippines, and they were all like, you know, except for Japan, the other three were saying, you know, this is great. And, you know, in fact, maybe it is better to have, you know, an Asian leader in the region and not be so reliant on the United States. More recently, when I revisited that question in some of the same places and then also in Vietnam, feelings were very different. It was like, okay, so now we see what a rising China acts like in our region, and we actually think having a little balance isn't a bad thing. There is some resentment about, you know, the U.S. getting too heavy-handed in the region, but to have some kind of U.S. military presence there as a balance is still seen as, you know, net-net positive for a lot of powers in East Asia, including Vietnam.
Hmm.
Well, yeah, I was really amazed to see, you know, the change in Vietnam's posture. But, you know, it kind of, you know, like during the Vietnam War, I remember, you know, talking to people, and, you know, people were saying, you know, if China, you know, if Vietnam wins, then, you know, China will, you know, there'll be communist takeover of all of East Asia and so on, this domino theory. But here you have, you know, Vietnam, you know, asking the U.S. to sell its weapons to protect itself against, you know, Chinese encroachments in that area. So, you know, the situation, you know, has changed. But I think that, you know, we have to look at you know, the actual, you know, size of the U.S. military presence there, which is like I've been saying, is very large.
Well, since you brought up Vietnam, let's talk about that aspect of the trip and the coverage of President Obama's decision to lift a longstanding U.S. arms embargo on Vietnam. At times, Time magazine, Time.com, Rishi Iyengar reports, some supporters of the arms embargo have cited Vietnam's poor treatment of its citizens as one of the primary reasons not to lift the ban. The country's communist government routinely jails dissenters, cracks down on the media, and quashes protests. Obama addressed the issue of human rights on Monday by calling it one of the areas where our two governments disagree. He added that the U.S. respects Vietnam's sovereignty and will not try to impose a democratic system on the country. Mary Kay, you reported from Vietnam for quite a long time.
7 years. 7 years. 88 to 95.
So what do you make of this angle?
Look, the Vietnamese are very concerned about the claims that China's making in the South China Sea. The U.S. is very concerned to keep sea lanes free in the South China Sea, to keep them open, because a lot of U.S. traffic, sea traffic, goes through there, and there are resources in the South China Sea. And there are basic issues of sovereignty as well. So when the U.S., when the Obama administration in particular, looks at, you know, what's going on in East Asia, and how are our interests being protected or not, and who can we partner with to make sure our interests are being protected? You know, the Chinese have no problem with partnering with regimes that are not, you know, really champions of human rights. And over time, the U.S. has seen, you know, sometimes we kind of need to make a compromise if we want to protect, you know, pragmatically protect our strategic interests. You can absolutely make a compelling and legitimate argument that, no, you should be looking at things like human rights and, you know, how dissidents and journalists and other activists are being treated in Vietnam. I will say, having first gone into Vietnam in 88 and having Vietnamese friends who I visit regularly, that there's a lot more freedom now than there was, a lot more. You know, people who would be looking over their shoulders if they got a visit from a Western journalist and would almost certainly be visited by the police shortly thereafter, are now running NGOs or making films or, you know, being able to comment much more freely. And it takes much more for the government to push back and say, okay, now you've crossed the line. Still not acceptable, but a lot better than it was.
And what about journalists inside Vietnam?
So same with them. So there's, and it's not unlike, say, how journalism was in China about a decade ago, which was that there certainly was a line. It kept moving. Journalists became a little bit more assertive at pushing it out and seeing, well, what can we do that's, you know, kind of in the realm of investigative reporting? If we can't get it in our paper, can we hand it to someone who can put it out online, or can we hand it to another journalist? Xi Jinping's government has not been very tolerant of that and has cracked down very hard on journalists who try to do enterprise reporting, investigative reporting, anything that's really critical of government policies. But there was a stretch of time of about 7-8 years when that was happening much more, and I think that is what's been happening in Vietnam.
I'd like to mention that, you know, as a journalist, I've written a lot about the labor situation in Asia, and Vietnam is one place where, unlike China, workers have the right to strike, and strikes actually happen there quite a lot. When I was in Korea, I was visiting a friend of mine, an American friend of mine, who spent 7 years in Vietnam with the International Labor Organization. He was telling me that, you know, one of the big needs there was for labor negotiators to train people in, you know, how to settle these kind of grievances. But it's very interesting that in Vietnam that they do have this right and do exercise it, a lot. Particularly in the southern part, where there's a lot of factories from, you know, foreign multinational companies manufacturing shoes and clothing. Mm.
And even though they're allowed to strike, though, Tim, wages in Vietnam, a key partner of the Trans-Pacific Partnership deal, are lower than Indonesia. So Nike's largest production center is in Vietnam,
right,
where 330,000 young women workers with no legal rights earn about 48 to 69 cents an hour. This is according to the Institute for Global Labor and Human Rights.
Well, they have no legal rights, but they do have the right to strike. No, you're right about that. I mean, the wages are lower. I haven't been there for, you know, years and years, so I leave it to Mary Kay to say, you know, in terms of, you know, what's a livable wage there. I don't know that much about that, but I know they are very low, and that's obviously why, you know, multinationals, you know, go there.
Yeah, no, I mean, obviously you have to look at purchasing power parity. You know, what can you buy for your 69 cents an hour? And is that better than what you'd be making? Is that more than what you'd be making on the farm? I mean, it's a stage of development, and many countries in Asia have gone through it, and they go through it pretty quickly. In Vietnam, I think the standard of living for many people has risen dramatically since I started going in there in the late 80s.
What are your thoughts about how this is being framed in the United States? Because, you know, some people are saying, well, there's no need to be concerned about the TPP because those jobs have already been offshored. What they're not saying is that a lot of multinationals, according to various reports, especially these human rights groups, say that if the TPP goes through, a lot of jobs will be shipped from China to Vietnam because companies like Nike and other multinationals can pay those workers even less.
It's already happening. It's been happening for the last 5 years because as wages have doubled and doubled again in southern China, as the new generation of workers coming up, which is smaller than the previous generations thanks to the one-child policy, you know, they can look at, you know, what their older brothers, if they have any, and, you know, uncles and fathers and so forth had done and say, yeah, I don't think so. You know, I'd like to do a different kind of work. And more young Chinese are going to higher education than ever before. More are going to cities and finding different kinds of work that doesn't put them in factories 12 hours a day, 7 days a week, where they're locked in the factories. And a lot of the factories have automated. You know, they have robots doing the work that factory workers used to do because it's cheaper and more reliable. And, you know, so multinationals come in and they say, okay, so we either have to pay twice as much for a Chinese worker to do this, even though you guys have a great supply chain. We still love that. And so for higher end manufacturing, we'll still come to you. But for clothes and shoes and, you know, belts, we're going to go to Cambodia. We're going to go to Vietnam. We're going to go to the Philippines. We're going to go to Bangladesh.
Right. And also there's a massive worker uprising in China, right? China Labor Watch is this organization that often posts stories, and Bloomberg has done some good reporting on that.
Well, there have been ongoing demonstrations over many years in China. And in fact, the Chinese government does take workers' concerns somewhat seriously. There have been rounds of arbitration with workers at factories where quite often things, at least about a third of the time, according to China Labor Bulletin in Hong Kong, things go in the workers' favor. And, you know, about a third of the time it's a compromise, and about a third of the time the boss wins. Mm-hmm. But, you know, that's not as bad as you'd think it could be if the Chinese government was like, you know, we're totally on the side of management. They recognize that they have to listen to workers at least to some extent, or they're going to have a much bigger problem on their hands.
Tim, what else would you add about the Trans-Pacific Partnership? I mean, Obama is pushing this really hard as his six potential successors oppose it. What do you think about that and how it's been covered?
Well, the as far as I know, it's sort of China will not be part of TPP. And it's sort of directed, you know, they want to integrate with, U.S. wants to integrate with countries outside of it as a way to sort of, you know, have this kind of U.S. involvement in the regional economy there. And I think that kind of runs a little bit against, sort of what's going on in East Asia. Because, I mean, I was, you know, astonished in South Korea this time, you know, how many Chinese, you know, visit there, particularly the island of Jeju, which is in the south, and, you know, Chinese can actually go there without visas. It's this beautiful island south of the mainland. But there's, you know, tremendous Chinese involvement with the South Korean economy. Lots of investment, and, you know, a lot of Koreans are like, well, you know, we don't want to have antagonistic economic ties or relations with China. We want to have friendly relations with them. But there's strong resistance there, you know, against this, in partly because of what they believe will happen to manufacturing jobs. And, you know, South Korean companies are sort of at the forefront of this globalization, and they often, you know, many of the conflicts, say, in Vietnam are with Korean managers of, you know, Korean companies that produce in these countries for big multinational retail outlets. that sell all over the world, and the companies are made by Korean manufacturers in these countries, like in Vietnam in particular. People really dislike the way Korean managers treat workers, and also in agriculture. You know, there's the free flow, so-called, of food products. You know, low cost wheat and other grains from the United States into Asia. For Koreans, it's really undermined the Korean farmers believe it's really undermined their prices there and undermined their livelihoods there. So there's tons of resistance there to it. And but I think I actually some of the coverage on the U.S. side from the sort of critics of TPP, I think, often sort of does not take into account the complexities of the region, the complexities and the historical roots of American involvement in East Asia. I mean, I don't think sometimes I think it leads a little bit too much to like us versus them. You know, we don't want to have these relations with these countries, and because it's going to undermine us, our economy, and this has been going on, as Mary Kay said, for decades, basically. Mm.
Well, we'll have to do a show about the TPP. It's a massive deal that would deepen economic ties between the United States, Canada, Mexico, Japan, Australia, Singapore. And according to Reuters, a number of technology companies, including Amazon, Facebook, and Uber, are going to push the next president to support the TPP so they can hire high-tech workers from abroad, which is another subject altogether, but we'll tackle that in the coming weeks. Mary Kay, what are you working on right now?
Oh, well, actually, my next podcast is an interview with Smari McCarthy, who is a member of the Icelandic Pirate Party, and he was the chief technology officer behind the Panama Papers.
Oh,
so he's talking about how all that came together and talking about, to push back against surveillance, to increase government transparency and distributed democracy in Europe and beyond.
And Tim, what about you? What are you working on?
I'm working on some stories from my trip to Korea. The other night, when I was in Seoul, I went to a hospital where there's a Korean farmer activist who was knocked in the head by these kind of hoses that the South Korean government uses to try to disperse demonstrations, and he suffered severe brain damage as a result of getting hit in the head and being knocked to the ground and bashing his head and having brain injury from this. It was a massive demonstration, labor and farmer demonstration, against the so-called labor reforms the Korean government's trying to pass, and also the opening of their market to grain, particularly from the U.S., that farmers believe is undermining their market. So I'm doing the story on this and the significance of this person to the Korean sort of democratic labor movement.
Tim Shorrock is a longtime journalist who writes about Japan and South Korea. Mary Kay Magstad spent more than two decades in East Asia from the 80s to 2013. Check out her podcast, Whose Century Is It? Tim and Mary Kay, thanks for joining us.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call. On the next Your Call, we'll rebroadcast our conversation with Jane Mayer, author of Dark Money, The Hidden History of the Billionaires Behind the Rise of the Radical Right. She lays out how the Koch brothers have used their fortune to push their anti-government and anti-tax agendas. They have funded hundreds of organizations to influence and ultimately control academic institutions, state houses, the courts, and Congress. That's on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Laura Flynn produces the show. Malihe Razazan is senior producer. Matt Martin is executive producer. And Rosalie Atkinson is our intern. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. And David LaTulipe is our studio engineer. Our theme music is performed and composed by Live Human. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.